Thank you. Pleased and honored to be here, but in the interest of time, I'm just going to jump right in. I'm here today to describe a healthcare influenza vaccination survey that the Minnesota Department of Health did last year. And we had many of the usual expectations that one usually has of a survey such as this, but there have also been some interesting, sort of unexpected, although I think related outcomes that have been a pleasant surprise as we've gone through sharing the survey results, and so I'll talk about some of them as we go along. I'm going to talk a little bit about survey background, methods, initial findings, and next steps. And I think each one of us on the panel here have told you a different national rate. The one I'm quoting is from the National Health Interview Survey from 2008, and it says that the rate is about 48%. I know there's some new data out now, too, that has come out recently with H1N1, but that's the one I'm quoting. The Minnesota Department of Health has set the standard for influenza vaccination of healthcare professionals at 90% to improve patient safety and quality of care statewide, and we did that back in 2007. But over the last few years, there has been a great amount of interest in really what Minnesota's rates are, because we didn't really know. And so with strong backing from the influenza subgroup of our Minnesota Immunization Practices Advisory Committee, we went ahead and did this survey. And the purposes of the survey were really to, again, collect Minnesota-specific employee influenza vaccination rates in healthcare settings, but we also wanted to get information on those vaccination activities that organizations were using. And so I certainly won't be talking about all these, but we're talking about things like vaccine delivery methods, promotional activities, educational activities, how they tracked their vaccinations, whether or not they used informed declination, and how that worked for them, and a little bit about how they did their evaluation of their programs. We were also interested in getting data on barriers to vaccination, and the last purpose of our survey was to get a little more information on the usefulness of our state immunization registry for these kinds of employee programs. Our survey population was all hospitals and nursing homes in Minnesota, and we actually did survey all hospitals, and then we did a random sample of the nursing homes in the state. And we had an online survey that was available mid-April through May 2009, and you're probably all saying, oh no. But we were able, even considering the last bullet down there, we were able to get a response rate of 62%, which I think is acceptable. We did a lot of reminding, both with via mail and email, but as you can imagine, our timing could not really have been worse, as hospitals were actively responding to H1N1 during the time that we were asking them to fill out the survey. Goody. I'm going to go quickly through some of the descriptive statistics. This analysis was actually done last summer while we had a little lull in some of the other activities we've been doing, sort of between waves. And then while many of us were involved in H1N1 vaccination campaign, this survey was just sort of put aside again. And then we've just in the last month or so been doing some additional analysis. So I kind of have two groupings of pieces of data analysis to share with you. This is the original descriptive stats that we did. And we did find an overall employee influenza vaccination rate, this was all facilities combined, of roughly 70% in our state. And we defined employees as all workers who collect a paycheck from the facility. We did that in an intentional manner so that we could compare apples to apples across facilities. And it really also helps to have that denominator be a number that everybody can agree on. Admittedly, this is a self-reported aggregate rate, and we acknowledge that there's probably response bias related to self-selection of facilities with high rates and established programs. So basically, we probably got a better response from those high achievers, but we like what we got anyway. As far as some of the other descriptive stats that we've been able to collect, we did, even though we only asked them for rates around their employees, we did ask them who else they were vaccinating in their programs, because we think that's a really important piece, and found that the most likely groups to be vaccinated were volunteers, licensed independent contractors and practitioners, and students. We're very pleased to find that 90% of the facilities that did our survey actually provided vaccination on site. They also, 86% also provided it during all work shifts, and 99% provided vaccination at no cost. We asked a little bit about delivery methods, which I mentioned earlier. Quite a bit of data related to this, but as you can see, the top three delivery methods that people cited were vaccination clinics and fairs, peer vaccinators, and mobile carts. And then regarding promotional activities, certainly the number one thing listed by respondents was using reminders, and over 90% used reminders. But 70% used some kind of a promotional campaign, and approximately 50% cited strong support by an administrator as one of the important promotional activities. We were specifically interested in finding out information about signed declination and the declination process. Of course, because CDC and many national organizations have said that this is a really good way to go, a number of our partners believe the same, and we actually have had a declination form template available on our website since 2006, and we do a fair amount of promoting of that. Basically, when we asked organizations, do you use a declination form as a part of your employee influenza vaccination program, we found when we looked at all programs combined that 70% did. And then we asked those who did use declination if it was actually mandatory for their employees to return the form, which really is a different question, and found that of that group, 73% did make it mandatory. But then we also wanted to hear from those facilities who are not using declination, some of the whys behind that. And the top three reasons that we heard were lack of time or personnel resources, the facility or someone in the facility not being convinced of the value of declination, and that leadership just didn't endorse it. We've also been looking at program characteristics of facilities with the very high vaccination rates, close to or above the 90% goal that we set, and we found that they basically provide flu vaccine at no cost to their employees during all work shifts. They expand vaccine offerings to those other workers that I just talked about on a previous slide, and they used reminder methods. Most also had a strongly motivated administrator leading their vaccination drive. Most held kickoffs, events, and campaigns. Almost all of them provided some sort of education on influenza and flu vaccine, and most of them used declination forms and required the return. Again, these high performers, they all evaluated influenza vaccination rates annually. They all set vaccination rate goals annually. Almost all of them tracked reasons why their employees chose not to participate, and they all tracked the previous season's data. And for those of you, some of you may recognize these four, they really are the Joint Commission standards, that the kinds of questions that are usually asked on Joint Commission site visits. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the recent analysis that we've been able to do. We've done some work at dividing up vaccination rates by facility types, and we have been able to see that there really is a difference between the hospital and long-term care vaccination rates, and it's a significant difference. Hospitals being approximately 77% and long-term care or nursing homes approximately 65%. We've also looked at using declination, does it show significance? And so again, this is from looking at all facilities combined, so nursing homes as well as hospitals, and we've found that yes, using declination or declination process is a significant factor. Rate difference are 75.5% to 59.9%. Again, remember, this is all facilities combined. The interesting piece is that when we divide out the groups by nursing homes and hospitals, our preliminary analysis shows that if you analyze these separately, there really is not a significance for the hospitals alone, but the significance is definitely there for the nursing homes. And the difference there for the nursing homes is 72 versus almost 55%. Very significant. We don't know for sure what the reasons are. We're speculating that the declination process is already more established in hospitals, and there's probably room for improvement in the nursing homes, but don't know for sure. And then among the subset of those facilities that use declination, we found a statistically significant difference in vaccination rates between those facilities that mandated declination and those that did not. And so you can see the difference there too. And that's important to us to know. As I said, we've just kind of gotten into some of the higher level statistical analysis. We'll be doing that more over the next month, as soon as I get back to the office. We're continuing to want to know which program elements are associated with significant differences in vaccination rates. We want to look at the non-responders. Since we only had a 62% response rate, we want to know, do they look different from our responders? And so we're doing some work on that. And we're certainly considering what some of the confounders in our survey might be. What's next, of course, we'll be finishing analysis, continuing to disseminate results, and we've been pretty much disseminating preliminary results all along as we've had them with our partners, because people have been have had a lot of buy-in to the survey and have really wanted to know what's going on. And I think one of the remarkable consequences, I think, have just been how many people have been interested in hearing about the survey, and I think it speaks to a little bit of what Patrick said about collaboration between partners. People like to make comparisons, and they like to listen to this data, and they like to find out what other people are doing. It seems to be important to them. So as we've been out there disseminating some of the results, last year at a meeting with our influenza subgroup, who I said was this rather influential group who got us going very much on this survey, they started to ask about what Minnesota could do, Minnesota being the Department of Health, around possibly doing some legislative policy discussions. And so what we have done over the last several months is go out and have some of those discussions with professional organizations, and actually a task force has been formed to kind of look at standardized influenza vaccination policies and procedures, or policies and processes. What we've kind of ended up after those discussions realizing is that currently in Minnesota there really is not the political will to support mandating declination or vaccination rate reporting, but there is really strong support for voluntary reporting and the development of a statewide reporting or recognition program. So we're involved in developing an action plan around doing just that. And we are partnering with the Minnesota Medical Association, the Minnesota Hospital Association, and the Minnesota Alliance for Patient Safety, and we're developing this recognition program as we speak. We also are trying, which I think is kind of unique, to find a way to use our registry to assess the rates for this recognition program, so can let you know more as we develop that, how that goes. We've also decided this year, just because it was such an unusual year, not to go out and get the vaccination rates like we did last year, but in lieu of that, as sort of a little bit of post-H1N1 evaluation, we are going to survey the hospitals regarding some of the LEIV non-acceptance that we saw during H1N1. I think what is most exciting to me is that we're actually able to use the data, or we're planning to, and we are starting to use the data from our survey results to drive both the recognition program development and other pieces that we want to work on in our programs. The significance that we saw around requiring declination, the fact that the nursing home group shows significance using a declination process, can all help guide some of our program elements. And we're also going, now that we know who the 90 plus high achievers are, we're going to do key informant interviews with those and help share the results from that with our partners. So in summary, we set the 90% goal back in 2007, had strong backing for a statewide survey, found the 70% influenza vaccination rate, have been doing some dissemination, even though we're not fully analyzed with our survey, which has really prompted comparisons and discussions that have been really moving a lot of our work forward. And it's really great to have data that can actually inform program activities at this point. And I have to thank a whole bunch of people who helped. And with that, I will turn it over to Megan.
I'd like to thank all three of our presenters for three really interesting, informative presentations. And they kept on time so well that we do definitely have time for some questions. So if you can step to the mic that's in the center of the aisle there and give your name and affiliation and ask away.
Hi, thank you for some really inspiring presentations. I work with the Indian Health Service and we're in the second year of an initiative to require reporting on influenza vaccination among our healthcare personnel. And we've achieved 73% coverage with seasonal flu and are currently have our policy out and are suggesting that perhaps we are going to require healthcare personnel vaccination, obviously getting a lot of pushback. And I wanted to ask you, and one of the comments that you'd made, Patrick, was about a unified definition of healthcare personnel. And then in New York, you mentioned how difficult your current definition was to implement. I'm wondering what your suggestions are for a good definition. And in New York, are you going to continue with the same definition you had, or are you going to be revising that?
Oh, it is on. I'm sorry. We are revising that definition, and we're making it simpler. It's going to be something to the effect of taking out that last part about those who may have contact with personnel, and make it just people who have direct contact or whose activities could lead to exposure of patients. And so, yeah.
Gene Robert Jeffroy, Arizona. Again, for both Massachusetts and Minnesota, or even New York, once you started to the planning and then eventually the selling of the program, how long did it take you to get everybody rolling? And then the following year, did you have to go back and train again the staff and try to sell the idea to maintain the same level or continuity?
It didn't take us much time because QIOs work with hospitals across the state, but we didn't attempt to require every hospital. We made a request to them. We did think it was important that they sign a form saying that they, not just them, but somebody at a higher level in the organization was willing to participate at all these levels. And what we've tried to do, not as successfully as I'd hope, you begin with a small number and you let them talk to their colleagues. It's not doing a program once, it's doing it repeatedly over time and let others know how well the program went and what they missed out on. Hospitals, for many of us, is relatively easy. I think they've got there are over 400 nursing homes in the state of Massachusetts. Getting them on board is much more difficult. And putting them in any kind of a workshop setting means multiple workshops compared to maybe two or three workshops for hospitals. But there has been, at this point, there's almost minimal resistance. The main issue is primarily they don't know always what to do. They are really looking for help from you or from their colleagues.
In Minnesota, our survey was actually a voluntary survey, so it was really up to them whether they chose, although we did do a fair amount of promotion. I think if we were going that route again, we would hope to see the rates go up every year, but we're actually kind of now formulating this recognition program that I talked about, and we really have high hopes that some of the competitive factors will play into having the facilities really want to be a part of our program and choose to report.
Andy Eisenberg, Texas. I have the ability to work at a number of different facilities. And I wonder if you had a comment about one that was particularly successful. And again, it was hospitals, but a certain corporation had a quasi-mandatory approach with you either got vaccinated or you wore a mask. And they had extremely high rates. And then last year's, maybe some CDC information looked at those that were generally non-acceptors or refusers who had been vaccinated at least one time in the future tended to get vaccinated again, realizing that all the myths that they had previously been susceptible to were obviously not true. So has there been much data on that, or anybody looking at the legal repercussions of the, it's not really a mandate, but certainly a suggestion?
I guess I'm not entirely understanding the question. Is anybody looking at the legal aspects of
the facilities that I work at? One of the corporations basically didn't mandate, but in their hospitals gave employees a choice. You got vaccinated or you wore a mask throughout the season. It wasn't a mandate that you do it because you had an option. If you wanted to refuse, right. Could have any reason. And they had exceptionally high rates of acceptance because of the hassle factor.
I do know that that's what they did at Virginia Mason Hospital in Washington State, and they got their rates up into the high 90s. So and I know that they've had legal challenges and have been upheld, as far as I know.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Marie Ostoyich. I'm Director of Public Health for Greene County, which is up in the Catskill Mountains of New York. I've worked closely on the other end of Dr. Blog's mandate, and I just wanted to say a couple of comments I'm not even sure if she's completely aware of, but we actually, as director, we had our staff getting ready to get immunized. We're a small health department. We were told that as long as they share the airspace, whether they're clinical or not clinical, they were expected to get the, quote, influenza vaccine, which also included H1N1. So we started vaccinating people. Most of them were fairly willing. And about 3 days into it, I got essentially a gag order from the county attorney and the labor attorney from CSEA, Civil Service Employees Association Union, telling me we were causing bodily harm and we could not continue. And we had a state survey coming up, so I was trying to make sure everybody was meeting the new mandate within that. So we stopped. And essentially what happened is then there was a shortage, and the state, when they came to do our survey, sort of let it go. The second piece that happened was nurses. Excuse me. And the nurses were willing to get the vaccine, H1N1 and influenza. But when we started requiring it, they opposed it because they said, you're taking away our rights. And that, again, was a union issue from a New York State Nurses Association. So I'm very happy to hear that there's some new language. But I was shocked. I'm a nurse. And I thought, causing bodily harm? And that was the terminology they used back to me. Any comments?
Of that, because that was one of the lawsuits, there was that it was suspended by a judge. But I guess I forget to mention that because it happened so simultaneously with us suspending the regs that it really wasn't in effect for more than a few days. So,
and that airspace issue, we had dealt with some physicians, I forget exactly who from CDC helped us with that, but because we're a small health department and everyone enters through the waiting room area, all of our employees as well as patients, they felt that even if they were clerical, reception, or whatever, there was possible exposure, even though they weren't truly giving direct care.
Yeah, that is somewhat consistent with where we're going with the definition of anybody who passes through patient areas. And in a local health department, that's not necessarily patient floors. It's more waiting rooms, and right. It's a little different, I understand.
Thanks.
I'm Richard Judelson, another New Yorker from the western part of the state, Erie County. And Dr. Blog, you said that the route to be considered this year is going to be different from the administrative rule that came into play last August. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about what that might be. And also, in crafting the development of that, has there been any communication with other states that are looking at doing something similar? And finally, your thoughts on what the health director from Greene County just mentioned about airspace, and that is, could you then logically say, well, anybody passing through the airspace in a healthcare facility, let's say a hospital, would include visitors and patients. And where does that line stop? And do you see a legal morass based on that almost endless extension?
Okay. Don't leave because I might not remember all the questions. In terms of going forward, it's the same process. We're going to do it through regulations. But the initial regulations were passed on an emergency basis, and we are now looking at having them passed on a permanent basis. It's still through SHRPC, through that body. So that's going to continue that process. And what was your second question?
Have you heard of other states looking at similar methodologies?
We got a lot of calls from other states, from lawyers and medical people from quite a few states that are very interested in what we were doing. And so I can only assume that they're considering their own legislative attempts. But I'm not aware of anything specifically going forward.
One thought I would have on that would be that you mentioned that the people, groups opposed to vaccination, found this a very attractive target.
They did.
to organize their efforts against. And might it not be helpful preemptively to get people who believe in the benefits of immunization, particularly influenza immunization, maybe like a National Foundation for Infectious Diseases, to be prepared proactively to work on this, maybe heading off some of the anti-vaccine noise, which will be very loud.
Absolutely, I think I agree, and that's something we are talking about, and we just don't know what the timing yet is going to be and when it'll happen, but I think that's something we have to take into consideration because the protests will be loud. They already were. And then your last question about airspace, that's something that we debated long and hard about, and we clearly felt that we could not have visitors be vaccinated. That was not practical or desirable, so it's clear to us that visitors are not included. With the exception of visitors, everybody who comes through a patient's care area is where we're looking. We did not think that people who go through the cafeterias or the outpatient, that's not a good example, but the cafeterias came up a lot in the discussions that it would not cover being in the cafeteria or on the main floors of hospitals or in the main lobby, but anybody going to patient floors. Not entirely consistent, but practical.
Okay, and our last question, and then I encourage people to come up and speak to our speakers afterwards for as long as they can stay, and I will serenade you with announcements as you leave.
Thank you. I'm Donna Lazorik, one of Patrick's co-conspirators. And I just wanted to say that in Massachusetts, we passed emergency regulations requiring, very similar to New York's, requiring hospitals, long-term care facilities, dialysis centers, and any clinics that were licensed by the department to offer influenza vaccine, both seasonal and H1N1, and have signed declinations if folks didn't want to get vaccinated. And we didn't get very much pushback. That being said, the pushback that we did get all came from nurses. As a nurse myself, I'm appalled by this. And I was just wondering if perhaps Denise or if anybody in the audience has had any experience working with the nursing unions to sort of overcome this barrier, because I expect that it is going to rear its head.
I don't know if Chris will want me to say this, but I would say of the professional organizations that we have been reaching out to and having discussions with, the Minnesota Nurses Association is the most challenging. And I'm a member of the organization, and I'm appalled by some of the things that have gone on too. So I think it definitely, and I think we strategically went to some of the other organizations first to try to sort of build a coalition because they were easier to work with and they bought into where we were trying to go. But we've had the same struggles.
All right, thank you all very much.